Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. While you're over there, make sure that you check out the events page, because registration is now open for Here We Still Stand National Conference. That's in sunny, amazing San Diego, California in October. We'd love to have you hang out with us. You can get all the information over on the website, or you can click the link in the show notes. You know, conferences sometimes, you know, I say conference, but this is a little bit different than a regular conference. This is a huge three-day party where you don't leave the site, and also guys like me and Chad talk sometimes. Come hang out, you know, do some singing, do some listening, but mostly do some eating and some hanging out and some fellowshipping, and that's what happens the vast majority of the time. It's great. All in one location. You never leave. You get to stay up late, hanging out with all these wonderful people, maybe people you haven't seen in a while, maybe people you just met. And then, you know, you drink a bunch of coffee in the morning and get ready to hear some people talk about Jesus. It's a pretty great time. I encourage you to check it out if you have never been. Make this the year that you do it. Chad, we are in 1 Kings chapter 20.
Yeah, we're going to take a break, actually, from Elijah. So we've been Elijah-ing the last two or three episodes, maybe more. But we're going to take a break in chapter 20. He does not show up. And I think part of the reason for that is going to be because, so in the last episode, we talked about how, you know, when he was threatened by Jezebel, he took off down south, ended up at Mount Sinai. He's complaining to God, saying, I'm the only one left, you know, woe is me situation. And one of the implicit messages of chapter 20, which follows right on the heels of that, is that Elijah is actually not the only one left. In fact, we're going to hear from some other prophets, not just one, but other, more than one prophet in chapter 20. So it's a way of the narrator underscoring the fact that, yes, I mean, Elijah is certainly a big deal. He is the Lord's prophet during this time period, but he's not the only prophet. There are other people who are also bringing the word of God, believing in him, being faithful. We're going to meet Naboth in the next chapter. He's another traditional, faithful Israelite, even though he's living in the northern kingdom. So it kind of a, you know, between the lines message in these next couple chapters is that Elijah is not the only faithful one. We have a whole lot of others out there. So we're gonna step aside from him for at least one chapter, and we're going to hear about some wars. And we're also going to encounter, I don't know how to quite put it, but a different side, we might say, of Ahab in this chapter. It's a little different. The Ahab we've met so far is a scoundrel, an idolater, who married an uber idolater. I mean, she is all about, Jezebel is all about idolatry. And we've talked how she's kind of the power behind the throne. And so our overall impression of Ahab is not even mostly negative, but almost entirely negative.
Do you think Jezebel, so this is Ahab's wife, is the most, okay, if you were this is the Bible. There's lots. Everyone's wicked in the Bible, but it does seem that Jezebel might be the most renowned wicked woman in the scriptures.
I think that's probably safe to say. Yeah, I mean, so much so that maybe you can help me out here. But in Revelation, one of the letters to the seven churches mentions that there is a Jezebel there, yeah. Right? Yeah, and I don't think that there was an actual woman with the name Jezebel in that congregation, rather that's being used typologically, that she is she's a Jezebel in the sense that she is promoting that which is false. And I know of no other occasion where a woman's name is used in that sort of way. So,
yeah, I remember growing up, we used to watch this movie. It's a great movie. Chad, you surely have seen this movie. It's called The Man from Snowy River. It's amazing.
Is an amazing movie.
It's great.
That is, yeah.
So yeah. Kurt Douglas's character, he's in a mine, and this mine won't give him any gold, and he's getting really super frustrated. And this is not a Christian movie by any means. And he takes his pickaxe, and he slams it into the side of, you know, of his mine where he's got all the rigging and stuff, and screams Jezebel to this to this mine. And then so he's so angry.
The most profane thing he can think of to say.
Yeah, so, and he always refers to the mine as a she. it's his girl. That's what he'll say. Mm-hmm. And then at one point he calls his girl Jezebel because she's betrayed him and is not producing any gold. So, I mean, I don't think there's any other woman in the Bible that you could do that with. I mean, the only other woman in the Bible. There's lots of, by the way. Like, the scoundrel dudes outnumber the scoundrel women in the Bible, a hundredfold. But the only other woman in the Bible I could think of that you're just like, man, I really don't like you, is Herod's wife, when she just tricks him into beheading John. You're like, you seem like a pretty terrible person. But
yeah, she seems like a sort of a New Testament Jezebel, for sure.
So that's the,
yeah,
the,
but
the,
when
the,
you...
There's your Old Testament, New Testament, terrible women in the Bible. But that's about it.
Yeah, I would not encourage anyone to start a sermon series on all the wicked women of the Bible, because you're probably going to run out pretty quickly.
Dude's
but
easy.
You could preach for years on the wicked men in the scriptures. Jezebel and Ahab. And in this chapter in 1 Kings 20, Ahab is different. And here's another difference, not just in what he does. He's actually going to listen to the prophets in this chapter. But there's even and you got to kind of pay careful attention to catch this. But once you see it, it's unmissable. So there's two chapters, 1 Kings 20 and then 1 Kings 22, where Elijah's absent. And in both of those chapters, there's a switch of terminology. So when Elijah is there with Ahab, Ahab is called Ahab. He's just called by his personal name. When Elijah is absent, he's referred to predominantly as the king. So it's almost like if Elijah's around, Ahab looks worse, because of course Elijah is so much more faithful than he is. But if Elijah's absent, the king looks a little bit better. So he's actually called the king. So he's Ahab when Elijah's around. He's the king when Elijah is absent. So the narrator is very, very slyly making these alterations as a way of affirming the fact that, yeah, Ahab he's a wicked guy, but he's also, there's some complications to him. Everything is maybe not quite as 100% straightforward as we might assume, as we will see as we get into this chapter about wars and second wars and mercy that's shown to a Gentile king. So the Gentile king we meet right away, his name is Ben-Hadad. He's the king of Syria. Syria, of course, is north of the northern kingdom. Syria, also sometimes called Aram. So Ben-Hadad's the king of Syria. He gets all his army together. We're told that he had 32 kings who were with him, along with the horses and chariots. This is a case, like a lot of other places in the Old Testament, where when we hear king, we think of like the leader of a country. But that's not always the way that kings is used in the Old Testament. Robert Alter, in his commentary/translation, says these guys were probably, because there's so many of them, they're probably like local warlords. So you can have like what today we would call the mayor of a city. In the ancient world, they might call a king. So right. A lot of kings were nothing more than just kind of local chieftains or the head of a community. So these 32 kings, local warlords, however you want to think of them, but you know, still a significant number, they get together with Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, all their horses and chariots. So they got their soldiers, they got their weaponry, and they basically go up and they surround Samaria. Samaria, of course, being the capital city of the northern kingdom where Ahab is king. So they surround the city, they fight against it, and then they decide they're going to send a group into the city. They send these messengers to the city in order to talk to Ahab. And they bring a message. And these guys, by the way, to say what I've said multiple times, these guys are Malakim, the singular, which is Malak. So the word usually translated as messenger. Angels are just messenger. These guys are messengers. These messengers, these ambassadors, we might call them, go into the city with a message from the king, from Ben-Hadad. And here's what they say. Your silver and your gold are mine. Your best wives, yell at not just your wives, but your best wives and children are also mine. This is not even like a request. it's not even necessarily an imperative, just like an indicative statement, right? Listen, your silver, your money, it's mine. Your best wives, mine. Your kids, mine. It's just kind of a blank statement as to this is the way things are. And the king answers, this is kind of a surprising answer, but the king answers and says, as you say, my lord, O king, I am yours and all I have. So at first Ahab is, I guess he is so, he's so overwhelmed by the superior forces, perhaps, and realizes he has no military alternative here. He's not like he's going to be able to amass enough troops and enough leaders to go against Ben-Hadad. So he basically is agreeing to these terms, if you can call them terms, these demands, these statements. And in doing so, is willingly submitting to the status of a vassal king, meaning that Ben-Hadad is his boss. Yeah, sure, Ahab is still at least he is a king, but he can't really do anything without Ben-Hadad's permission, and he's going to have to give him whatever he wants, his best wives, his kids, his money, whatever Ben-Hadad wants to take from him, he's going to have to be willing to hand that over.
Yeah, I wonder if he's just hoping that Jezebel is in that best wives category.
I would assume that she, from our perspective, no, she's not the best. But from Ahab's, I don't know how she wouldn't be. I mean, she's obviously the queen, so she's got to be the quote-unquote best of the best wives. One way to get rid of Jezebel.
Yeah, so he's like, maybe silver lining this. Well, if nothing else, I'll get this woman out of here.
Yeah, Ben-Hadad might regret making that demand. So that's kind of the first stage of this. City surrounded, and King Ahab says, all right, whatever you say, I'm yours. I am your servant. But then notice what happens next. This is verse 5. Well, the messengers come back. So they go, they take this message to Ben-Hadad, but then they come back with another message. And this second message, Ben-Hadad evidently wasn't satisfied with that. He sends him again saying, I sent to you, implied here, I sent to you beforehand, saying, deliver to me your silver and gold, your wives and your children. The best part is left out there, just your wives and your children. Nevertheless, he goes on in this second message, I will send my servants to you tomorrow about this time, and they shall search your house and, now this is the important part, and the houses of your servants, and lay hands on whatever pleases you and take it away. So this is a much more expansive list of terms. Before, Ahab is saying, okay, I'll submit to be vassal king. I'll do that. But now what's going to happen? Well, now in the second and more encompassing demand, he's going to come and he's going to actually search. He's going to search your house and the house of your servants. Now, I think what Ahab might be thinking here, and we'll see his response in just a second. I think what he might be thinking is, uh-oh. Now, it's one thing if I submit to being a vassal king, but if I submit to the people in my court, my servants, to having their houses searched and their stuff taken, I'm going to have a coup on my hands.
Yeah, you have to understand that by servants, he doesn't mean like the people, the
butlers.
Yeah, the butler and the person washing the dishes. It's not what he's talking about. He's talking about the people who serve with the king.
Yeah, so this is these are the powerful people. So yes. His servants are basically his the people that he would rule with alongside, his counselors and whatnot. So verse 7. So they first message, Ahab says yes. Second message, Ahab is going to say, let me talk to some people. So verse 7, he calls together the elders of the land. Elders, of course, are a very common group in the Old Testament and New Testament, as far as that goes, the leadership, basically. So he calls together the elders of the land, the group of leaders, and he says, mark now and see how this man, Ben-Hadad, how this man is seeking trouble. For he, literally evil, ra'ah. He's seeking trouble, he's seeking evil, he has evil intent, we might say. For he sent to me for my wives and my children and for my silver and gold. And I didn't refuse him. So first request, first demands, I said yes. And then we assume he goes on to explain, but he sent these other messengers with this more encompassing request. So how do the elders and all the people respond? They say to King Ahab, well, then don't listen to him. Don't listen and don't consent. And that's what he does. Verse 9 says, he said that Ahab said to the messengers of Ben-Hadad, tell my lord the king, all that you first demanded of your servant, I will do. But this thing, that is this second demand, I cannot do. So the messengers leave, and they brought word again. And then Ben-Hadad responds this. We can't hear this back and forth. So the messengers come, the messengers go, the messengers come, the messengers go. Ben-Hadad says, so he makes an oath here. The gods do so to me and more also. If, now I'm going to read from the ESV here, and then I'm going to offer an alternative translation. If the dust of Samaria shall suffice for handfuls for all the people who follow me. Well, that's a little confusing. I read that. I read it in some other English translations, and for the life of me, I couldn't make sense of it. So Robert Alter, whom I quoted just a few minutes ago, he says that rather than translating this as handfuls, we should probably understand this Hebrew word to refer to footsteps, kind of footfuls, if you will. And so here's how he translates. And this makes a lot more sense. He says, the gods do so to me and more also. If the ground of Samaria, that is the dust or ground of Samaria, will be enough for the footsteps of all the troops that are at my heels. In other words, here's what's going to happen. If you don't follow what I said to do, then there's not going to be enough room in Samaria. There's not going to be enough dust in Samaria for all the troops that I'm going to bring into your city. That makes a lot more sense. So obviously it's a threat. We're going to take over, and you're going to regret saying no to this second, more demanding request of mine.
Yeah, that makes a lot more sense. Initially, you read that, if someone made that threat to you, you would definitely be like, okay.
Don't really get what you're saying, but yeah. I was reading that this morning. I was like, I had no idea what that's supposed to mean. So Alter's translation makes a lot more sense. Now that we kind of understand the threat, now listen to Ahab's response. So for all the bad stuff that we can say about Ahab here, I mean, what a great response. This has got to be one of the, it's first of all, it's even pithier in Hebrew. It's like four words in Hebrew. But of course, typically Hebrew takes a lot more English words to translate. But here's how the ESV has Ahab responding. Let not him who straps on his armor boast himself as he who takes it off. That's a pretty good retort, wouldn't you say? Yeah. So don't be boasting like you've just won the victory and are taking off your armor. Let not him who straps on his armor boast as him who takes it off. So I'm sure one of our listeners is going to be using that pretty soon in a conversation that he has. It's going to be a great, great retort. It's kind of like the Old Testament version of what? Don't count your chickens before they're hatched.
Yes, that's exactly what I was going to say. That's what it is. That's like the military version of that.
Yeah. So instead of talking about not counting your chickens before they're hatched, please, next time, quote the Bible. Just say, let not him who straps on his armor boast himself as he who takes it off. Now, verse 12. How is Ben-Hadad going to respond to this retort? Here's the message. Now, this is significant. He gets this message while he's doing what? While he's getting drunk. He's drinking with the kings, that is those 32 warlords, in their tents. So this does not bode well for Ben-Hadad. Almost without exception, when people are drunk in the scriptures, what follows is not good for them. It's not going to be to their advantage. So Ben-Hadad, he hears a message. He's getting drunk with these 32 warlords. And so he says to his men, take your positions. And they took their positions against the city. So he's decided in his half-drunken stupor that he's not going to put up with Ahab trying to rebel against him. He's going to teach him a lesson.
Yeah, so when you're drunk, you decide, let's do this right now.
Yeah, always a good decision. Yes. Yeah. Hold my beer. Let's go and we'll take care of this Ahab character once and for all. So that's kind of what's going on back in Ben-Hadad's camp, getting drunk with his 32 warlords and saying, hey, let's take up our positions. We're going to go attack Samaria. Now, switching positions, what's happening back where King Ahab is? Well, verse 13 tells us that a prophet, so this isn't Elijah, this is some anonymous prophet, one of the other faithful followers of Yahweh. Behold, a prophet came near to Ahab, king of Israel, and said, thus says the Lord. So I've got a word from God, not just a God, but a word from Yahweh for you. And here's what he says. Have you seen all this great multitude? Talking about the troops of Ben-Hadad. Have you seen this great multitude? Behold, I will give it into your hand this day, and you shall know that I am Yahweh. And Ahab responds, by whom? Meaning, who is going to win this great victory? And he says, thus says the Lord. So he says, I've got another word from God for you. The answer to your question is, by the servants of the governors of the districts. So they're going to be the ones who are going to fight this battle. Now, these guys are not necessarily trained warriors. The servants of the governors of the districts are not kind of your military leaders. They're just going to be guys, we might say. And then he said, Ahab says, who shall begin the battle? And he answered one word, you. So you're going to go out, Ahab. You're not going to send somebody else. You're going to go out. You're going to have the servants of the governors of the districts as your men, your fighters. Now, what's Ahab going to do? Well, in this case, he actually listens to the prophet. He does what he says. And this is this side of Ahab that I mentioned a few minutes ago. This is kind of a side of him where he's actually doing what he's supposed to do. So he musters the servants of the governors of the districts. And get this, there were 232 of them. That's a pretty small force when you consider how many guys that Ben-Hadad must have. And now Ahab, he's got 232. So this is your typical David and Goliath situation here that we encounter multiple times in the scriptures. Of course, we see it with the Israelites in the wilderness when the Egyptians attack. We see it in the case of Gideon, where he has to, you know, take his men down to just 300, his 300 dog soldiers, and they attack the horde of the Midianites and the Amalekites and the men of the east. So now we have 232 followers of King Ahab. He musters all of them together, and then he gets the rest of his troops, and they number 7,000. But his kind of the point of the spear, if you will, is 232. Verse 16 recounts what happens. They go out at noon while Ben-Hadad was drinking himself drunk back in the tents.
So he's still drinking.
He's still drinking. Now, think about this. What time of day is it? Noon. So this guy, you know, forget breakfast. He just grabbed a six-pack. He's starting out. He's not only day drinking, he's like morning drinking. He's breakfast drinking. Gets out of bed, starts getting drunk.
This seems like something you only do if you're just supremely confident.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, this is like brazen, arrogant overconfidence here on the part of Ben-Hadad. He's like, Ahab, Israelites, no problem. I can win this battle intoxicated is what he is kind of the message.
This sort of, don't celebrate like someone who's taken off their armor and stuff. This does seem like you're literally getting drunk. Like you're celebrating like you've just won something before the thing has even started.
Yeah, that's right. That's a great point. It's like they're having a victory feast. They're having a victory drinking party before the battle's even begun. Slightly overconfident here.
Yeah. So for Ahab, this had to have been a little bit of a weird thing too, because if you put yourself in Ahab's situation, you got a prophet coming to you and saying, all right, this is what Yahweh says. Now, there's two ways this can go. If you're Ahab, and I would assume you'd be thinking about both these things. One, you could be like, well, I did just see Yahweh consume out of heaven, like a whole entire altar and lick up all the water. And I mean, I've seen Yahweh do something that would be pretty useful in this situation. Mm-hmm. Like he seems pretty powerful, so that's good. On the other hand, my psycho wife does have this prophet running for his life currently. So you have to, you're like, I know this God can do stuff, so that's good. But also, is this God trying, is he angry with me and setting me up?
Is he luring me into a trap?
Yeah. I mean, I would be thinking that. I would be like, ooh, like, I know this God has got some power, but also, like, I'm not sure I'm on his good side right now.
I don't know how I wouldn't be thinking both those things.
So you got to give him credit for deciding to go through with it, because I mean you could be thinking like, dude, the last thing I need to do is deal with Yahweh right now. Like, I don't think he's very pleased with me.
Yeah, you give credit where credit is due. He does this. We're told that while Ben-Hadad is drinking himself drunk and he's got his 32 warlords with him, that the servants of the governors of the districts went out first, so they're with Ahab. Ben-Hadad, he sends out scouts, and they report to him, men are coming out from Samaria. So these scouts, you see these guys coming, Ahab with his 232 guys. And then Ben-Hadad responds, he says, well, if they've come out for peace, take them alive. Or if they come out for war, take them alive. In other words, make them POWs, capture these guys. And it says, verse 19, that these went out of the city, the servants of the governors of the districts, and the army was following them. And then what'd they do? Each one struck down his man. So as soon as they got to where the men of Ben-Hadad were at, battle ensued, and the Israelites struck down the servants, the soldiers of Ben-Hadad. And the result was so overwhelming that the Syrians fled. They took off, and Israel chased them. And the only way that Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, got away is he jumped on a horse and he was able to ride away to safety. Somehow, I guess he wasn't so intoxicated he couldn't hang on to the saddle. But he gets away. But the king of Israel, that is Ahab, went out and struck the horses and chariots and struck the Syrians with a great blow. So overwhelming success given to the Israelites, not because they were superior warriors, not because they had a superior military battle plan, but because God had promised through that prophet to Ahab that they would be successful. So this, in other words, is thematically connected to all of these victories of the people of God throughout the Old Testament, where they're facing overwhelming odds, and it seems on the surface as if there's no way they can win, and yet they do. And why do they win? It's always, of course, because God has given them the success. Now, verse 22 says, the prophet came near to the king of Israel and said to him, come, strengthen yourself, consider well what you have to do, for in the spring, the king of Syria will come up against you. So this is his way of saying, you won the battle, but the war is not over. In other words, he's going to be coming back. So make preparations that you need to make, because come springtime, we're going to have a replay of this battle, and I want you to be ready when that happens. Now, verse 23 tells us that the servants of Ben-Hadad had something to say to him. They had to explain, now, why did we lose? I mean, we had such overwhelming numbers, so why were the Israelites able to beat us? And they give not a military explanation, but a theological explanation. So the servants tell Ben-Hadad, here's why we lost. Because their gods are gods of the hills, so they were stronger than we are. But let us fight against them in the plain, and surely we shall be stronger than they. And do this, they say. Remove the kings, each from his post, and put commanders in their places, and muster an army like the army that you have lost, horse for horse, chariot for chariot. Then we will fight against them in the plain, and surely we shall be stronger than they. So they give a theological explanation, which is, of course, very, very common idea among the ancient peoples, that different deities were limited geographically. So the gods in Egypt did not act outside of Egypt. The gods of the Syrians typically did not act outside of Syria. And so they transferred this theological perspective to Israel and said, oh, well, of course, yeah, that's why, because their gods are the gods of the hills and the mountains, which is where Samaria is located geographically. And so that's why we're on that God's home turf in the hills, and that's why we lost. What we need to do is transfer the battle down to the plain, closer to our God's place, in order that we might win the victory. So we'll see what happens in the spring when we get to the next battle.
That seems like, I mean, I'm sure that they somewhat believe this. This also seems like a convenient thing to tell your king. Like, what happened there? Tell you what, man, those hill gods, we can't fight against the gods. We have to bring them down here. Perhaps this is the only thing that they could muster up in their head to figure out what's going on. Because I think it shows you the miraculous nature of the victory. Like, the victory should not have happened. And so the only thing to do is attribute it to something completely external.
Yeah, it's the only thing that makes sense. Yeah, they're not going to be able to explain this in worldly terms.
No, they can't go in there and be like, well, here's what they did. They had a great plan, and here's how they executed it. No, they're just like, obviously there was a God involved.
When you don't have another explanation, you go for the supernatural.
Yeah.
I suppose. So verse 26 is going to, some time has passed, so we heard what's happening back in Israel. We heard the explanation given in Syria. And then we're told in verse 26 that in the spring, now this is literally in Hebrew, that's at the turn of the year, which of course kind of makes sense with the Israelite year beginning in the spring. So at the turn of the year, this, by the way, is the exact same expression used in 2 Samuel chapter 11 for at the turn of the year, or in the spring of the year, when kings go out to battle, David stayed in Jerusalem. So that whole setup for what happened with Bathsheba and Uriah is framed in the same sort of way. In other words, you don't fight battles in the wintertime. That's when that's the rainy season. It's cold, and it's just not good battle conditions. So, you know, just like we have various seasons for our sporting events, they had various seasons for their wars, their battles. And so they don't fight in the wintertime. Instead, they wait for the spring. So it's time for war. It's springtime, probably the month Nisan. And Ben-Hadad of Syria musters all his troops, and he goes up to a place called Aphek to fight against Israel. The people of Israel were mustered. They were provisioned, and they went against him. Of course, Ahab had been told by the prophet this was going to happen, so they needed to be ready. But even though they had time, they were still outnumbered. There's kind of an unusual idiom that's used here. In fact, I don't know if it's used elsewhere except this verse. It says, the people of Israel encamped before them like two little flocks of goats. So, yeah, just, you know, a couple little flocks of soldiers, flocks of goats out there. But what about the Syrians? They filled the country. So, again, we're facing overwhelming odds here. The Syrians vastly outnumber the two little flocks of goats that are the Israelites. But once more, verse 28, God sends a messenger. This time he's not called a prophet. He's called an Ish Elohim, a man of God. That is a phrase for prophets that we've seen multiple times. So a man of God came near and said to the king of Israel, here's what God says. Thus says Yahweh, because the Syrians have said, Yahweh is a God of the hills, but he's not a God of the valleys. Therefore, I will give all this great multitude into your hand, and you shall know that I am Yahweh. I am the Lord. So the word's going to come back to haunt them. They said, oh, well, the reason we were beat is because, you know, the gods of the Israelites are gods of the hills. And now that God, Yahweh, comes back and says, oh, yeah, well, I'm going to show you. I'm not bound by geography. I'm the Lord of heaven and earth. And so if I gave victory in the hills, I'm also now going to give victory in the plains.
Yeah, the creator of all things is about to let you know he cannot be contained to one spot.
You want to fight land, air, or sea? Yeah. All right, I'm going to show you. I'm the God of all of those places. So they, verse 29 says, they encamped opposite each other for 7 days. Now, this is the first clue that we are watching what should we call it? Where history rhymes. So history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes, as Mark Twain supposedly said. So we're going to see a rhyme here. And the rhyme is going to be between what's happening now and what happened back in the book of Joshua with the conquest of Jericho. It's going to happen more ways than one. Remember, Jericho, the Israelites did what for 7 days? They marched around the city for 7 days. Now, these two armies are going to face each other for 7 days. And we'll see more parallels in the verses that follow. So on the seventh day, the battle is joined. And the people of Israel struck down the Syrians, 100,000 foot soldiers in one day. And the rest did what? They took off. They fled into the city of Aphek. And here's our other Jericho parallel. The wall fell upon 27,000 of the men who were left. So just like Jericho was surrounded by for 7 days by the Israelites, and then they conquered the city of Jericho, and the walls came tumbling down upon the people of Jericho. Now, the people who survived the battle in the plains and the valleys, the wall falls upon them, the wall of the city, not of Aphek, not of Jericho, but of Aphek. So we got the parallel set up here. You got the Israelites against the Syrians, just like you had the Israelites against the people of Jericho. 7 days, wall falls down, kills a lot of the enemy. There's going to be one more parallel here, too, as we go our way through this. Now, Ben-Hadad, who's the king of Syria, he takes off, and he hides in this inner chamber in the cities. And his servants, they're at their wits' end. They say, listen, here's our only chance. Our only hope is that we've heard that the kings of the house of Israel are, this just kills me, are kings of Chesed. Literally, translated by the ESV, are merciful kings. Now, I don't know where they heard that from, because everything that we've seen of these kings of the northern kingdom doesn't seem like they're very full of chesed, very full of mercy or loving kindness. But that's the rumor.
It must
that's
be
what they tell them anyway.
It must be only by comparison.
Maybe by comparison, yeah. I mean, they're not nearly as bad as the Assyrians or somebody else. These guys are merciful. At least relatively speaking. So here's their plan. They say, let's surrender. But here's how we're going to surrender. We're going to put sackcloth on ourselves, and we're going to put ropes on our heads. Now, I haven't been able to figure that out. The best explanation I read is that it's kind of like they hung a rope around their neck, in the sense that they show themselves willing to be, as it were, led captive. Kind of the, not hanged, but like the idea of... I think there's some ancient art in the Near East where you have slaves or prisoners of war being led away with a rope around their neck. So yeah. Presumably that's what this is communicating.
This just sounds like the plan is to fake some repentance.
Pretty much. Yeah.
Like, hey, like, what we'll do is we'll just tell them we're sorry.
Yeah, that's all they're gonna do. we're sorry. We're gonna put the sackcloth on, fake repentance, fake submission, and it works. They do that. They go out with sackcloth, ropes around their necks. They go out, and they meet the king of Israel. And here's what they relay. They say, your servant Ben-Hadad says, please let me live. Ahab says, does he still live? He is my brother. No idea why Ahab says that. Presumably, he's giving some political calculations here as to what would be the best approach here. So, does he go ahead and destroy every remnant of Ben-Hadad's army, including Ben-Hadad himself? Or does he maybe see, and we'll actually see this in a second, does he see some financial possibilities opening up here if he lets him live? So he calls him his brother. And the men who were sent from Ben-Hadad were watching for a sign. And so as soon as they hear this, they're like, oh yeah, yep, your brother Ben-Hadad is alive. So Ahab says, we'll go bring him. So Ben-Hadad comes out, gets into the chariot with Ahab, and so you have these two kings, and basically what happens is they enter into a deal. Ben-Hadad says, look, my dad, my father, king before me, took a bunch of cities from your father, so I'm going to give those back. All those cities that were conquered by him and now are under our control, I will, as part of our kind of treaty here we're making out, I will give those back to you. And then, not only that, but I will let you establish basically trade. The ESV has bazaars. That's kind of a loose translation, but we'll go with that. Establish bazaars. So you're going to be able to trade in the streets of Damascus, as my father did in Samaria. So it's kind of a turning of the tables here. So my father took these cities. I'm going to give them back. And my father was able to trade in Samaria. Well, I'm going to let you trade in my capital city of Damascus. And Ahab agrees. He says, all right, I'll let you go on these terms. And so they cut a covenant with each other. And Ahab let Ben-Hadad go. Now, as we'll see in our next episode, that was a bad idea.
That's consistently a bad idea.
Consistently a bad idea. When you've got the Gentile king in your, literally in your chariot, in your control, and you let him go, not a good plan.
No. Well, we'll have to leave it right there. We got some real interesting stuff coming up in the next episode. And we're going to find out how this letting the Syrian king go goes. Shocking. God is not all that pleased with that. But we'll have to wait until next week to get into it. Chad, I'll see you then.
All right. See you then.